What's the secret to scale any sort of organization? So I had the pleasure to speak in this episode with Elias Ghanem, the global head of Capgemini Research Institute for Financial Services. In my episode with him, we had a great conversation about the impact of multicultural approach when it comes to scaling organization and primarily, you know, startups or scaling up companies, but also what are the attributes and the skills and the traits that we need from CEOs if they really want to be effective to scaling any sort of organization. So stay tuned, because that's going to be a very practical but also insightful episode. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to a new episode of the World Class Leader Show. Today, I have the pleasure to have with me a new friend, Elias Ghanem. Elias is the global head of Capgemini Research Institute for Financial Services. He is responsible for all thought leadership initiatives for the firm, including the renewed World Report series and top trends books in financial services. Elias was previously the chief new technologies officer and fintech lead for Capgemini FS, engaging with fintechs and insurtech scale-ups to actively and efficiently embed them with Capgemini clients. Elias is a payments expert with over 20 years of industry experience at Visa first and then PayPal. We are all spanning from APAC head of Visa Consulting to PayPal regional IMD in Southeast Asia and in India and the Middle East. In 2013, he launched Teller in Singapore and Dubai, an online payment gateway, winning the 2014 Startup of the Year award in the MENA region. He advises several high-growth and disruptive payment startups in Washington, Singapore, Barcelona, Beirut, and Dubai. He's also a board member of some of these companies. Elias is also a certified scaling up coach, and we will go a little bit deeper into this. I'm so curious. And Elias has lived in the US, Latin America, and APAC, Middle East, and Europe, and is fluent in English, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Arabic. Wow, Elias, what a profile, what a career. So congratulations.
Hola, shall I say. Thank yes. you so much for having me with you, Andrea, today.
Hola, yeah, sí. Podemos hablar en español, but there is some risk that we're going to get. You're going to be very familiar with that. I'm going to lose at some point, so I don't want to get into that. Elias, so thank you so much for being on the show. So it's a pleasure to have you with us, first of all. Elias, so when we had a conversation before, you know, we said that we would really want to talk about this idea of scaling organization. What does it mean from a leadership standpoint? And we're going to get into this. But one thing that really comes to mind when I have seen your profile and when I just actually ready right now, you know, you have such a multicultural career. So you've been in so many different places. As I was, I think you beat me, you know, massively. But is there any specific learning that, you know, you would like to share with us, with the audience, in terms of, you know, what does it mean being a leader in a multicultural environment?
Thank you. I think it's a very good question, opening question, because it is my career, my old career, and my accent, nobody's able to catch exactly where I'm from. Of course, I'm French, as you can. It's a dominant one. But when I speak Spanish, it's a mix of Spanish from Spain, from Argentina. When I speak Portuguese, it looks more Portuñol. And that's the beauty of it. So for me, I always say my main job is traveling the world. It doesn't pay well, so I have to do something against it to make a living. Two things that I would say about my multicultural background is it is amazing, and it's a must do for everyone listening to our show today. There is nothing better than having a large scope, a large culture in your mind and discover the other. So first thing is do it. Second thing is doing for a certain time. Mm. And I would say the third thing, don't do it for too long. What we've done with my wife and my family is we've always passed anything between 4 to maximum 8 years in a country. And four is the perfect average on a country. Why is that? Because you land in a place, and even if you go to paradise, you will find it hell. You are lost. You don't know how to the language. You don't know how to find your way around. And first year is tough. When you are there, by the way, first year, party. Get to know everyone around in the community and make your choice. Second year, you start to balance, starting to find that there is better things than worse. Third year is fantastic. Fourth year is the most dangerous one. Because if you stay longer than four, you are hooked to stay forever. And the only place where we stayed 8 years was Miami. But what did we do? We changed house and we had two more kids. So it was a new life for us. So I would say do it as much as you can in your career, do it in different languages, learn languages, do it for a period of 4, 6, max 8, but avoid 8 because it becomes quite difficult to move after. And put yourself in stress. This is not your culture. This is not the French way of doing business. This is not the UK, the US way or the UK way. Mixing cultures is, for me, the most rewarding experience in my life.
I love that. And by the way, it's interesting, you know, your analysis about the 4 years and not going into potentially, you know, more than four for the good reason that you shared. It actually resonates with my story because I've never been more than 4 years in a country. And I think I got the most out of that. And now I think it resonates. It makes sense to me based on what you shared. The other thing I would like maybe to mention is you said a great thing about mixing cultures. And for me, one thing I learned, actually, one of my first job when I started to work in West Africa was something I learned in a course that was given to me at the time from my own employer. And they mentioned this idea about culture A, culture B, and culture C, meaning everyone brings his own culture, which is culture A, and then you work in a different culture. It could be culture B for a good reason, could be very different than your culture A. But the key is not really trying to bring your A into the B and turning the B into the A or vice versa. It's more about creating new culture, a kind of a C culture that gets the most out of both cultures so you can really live together in the middle of that. I think it's been always good advice for me.
So, I never get bored in meetings where there are more than one culture.
Yes.
You put me in a meeting with only French people speaking French and in France. Oh my God, I miss something. You put me in anywhere in the world with people of all colors, of all accent and all perspective. What an interesting engagement. What an interesting conversation. Sometimes confusing because people speak more than others. People speak louder than others. People want to monopolize the conversation. But there is life. There is something happening around us.
Yeah. And I think if you approach these conversations with the right mindset and with the idea of mastering your ability to stay connected, engaged in a conversation with so different culture, the same time around the table, I think is really, really useful. It's a great skill, by the way, for the current time. So love that. Elias, I want to understand a little bit more about, you know, especially for the sake of the audience, what does it mean really working, you know, in Capgemini right now, primarily related, of course, to your role of, you know, leading the research institute. So we have probably all of us, we have a feeling what does it mean in terms of, you know, doing research and publishing, you know, your findings. Why is it important for you and for the future of the organization?
Look, if I were to give you a quick overview of Capgemini. Capgemini is a large consulting firm. We are focusing on digital transformation. We take all sectors, banking and financial services where I am, but also public sector, but also aeronautic and so on, and we transform them into digital. It's already quite exciting for me because I believe that we need to adopt what we are living in, right? There was the industrial transformation and people who did not adopt it disappeared. Now we are into digital transformation and we need to adopt it, adapt it, and leverage it. That got me quite excited. The second thing that got me most excited is the intercultural. We are roughly 400,000 people and we are originated in France. But we are across the globe and we play a lot on the right shoring. We believe that to best serve your client, you need to have people on the onshore, people in the same country. You need to have people near shore, which is markets around where you are, but a little bit further away, with a lower price tag and some different of time zones, so which you can continue the work. And then finally, we need to have offshoring. And we have a lot of our staff that are out of India, out of Vietnam, out of Mexico, out of Brazil. And all these people provide services to our client across the globe on an offshoring. And for me, it creates a fantastic mix of cultures. So one, digital transformation. Second, culture, mix of culture. And third, where is my job come to play, is thought leadership. There are more questions than answer outside. And God's sake, there is plenty of content. Everybody has an opinion on everything, right? You, between Google and now ChatGPT, you throw any question and you have plenty of answers. But answers are not thought leadership. Answers are point of views. Answers are, if you add A plus B equals C. Thought leadership is when you consider different elements together in a given industry, in the retail banking industry. If you consider the last 20 years, the number of branches that went down, and you correlate that with the number of digital banks that are born and the hundreds of millions of customers that are shifting from a traditional bank to a digital one, this has become thought leadership. What is happening? What is the macro trend that you're observing? And what can you do with data points that might be not related, but at the end of the day ended up being extremely related? That's what I really most enjoy in my job, is bringing together the multicultural, bringing together the transformation, and giving advice to our client and saying, what is it for you? What does it mean, these elements coming together? That's what is my day-to-day at Capgemini.
Yeah, it's great. You have been giving very good different colors and flavors to what does it mean, from, you know, more dry perception people might have in terms of research. And also, I'm glad that you are using actually your experience and multicultural skills to actually work in such a very, very globalized context as Capgemini is at the moment. So it's great. As I mentioned, at the beginning, so one thing that to me is quite interesting is going back to, and maybe there are some lessons from your current role, of course, but going back to your experience working with startups, would you like maybe just to share briefly what has been a little bit more your experience in terms of supporting these startups, while you were working in a tech space, essentially?
Look, my love story with startups has been for quite some time. I started my career with Visa, and Visa is a large organization. It's not a startup. Solid.
Yes.
Changing the way we do payment and impacting the entire value chain of payment. This is where I discovered what you could do, the power of payments in our daily life, right? We do payment 24/7. Since we wake up to the time we go to bed, it's a payment after payment after payment. Then I moved to PayPal, and PayPal focused a lot at the time into the whole startup ecosystem. So mm-hmm. I started to get to know plenty of startups, and for me, startup is a virus. So I caught the virus when I was at PayPal, and then after a few years, I got approached by a VC. Who said, out of Singapore, who said, look, we believe that you know payments, Visa, and then PayPal, that you are from the Middle East, I'm Lebanese, and I was running at the time PayPal in the Middle East. And they said, why don't you come and do a payment gateway with us? So I found the opportunity great, and I said, look, we always need in our life one of the other things. One is travel, the other one is do a startup. And I would say the third one is write a book, but I'll stick with the second one. Do a startup. And I said, look, it's the right time for me to try to do a startup. The VC was fantastically supportive in funding me first, helping me build the story of a payment gateway built in the Middle East by Middle Eastern. And that's how we launched Teller. By the way, for the joke, we called it Teller, T-E-L-R, instead of T-E-L-L-E-R. We said because we want to make it so simple that your teller will be four letters instead of six letters, just for the joke of it.
Right.
And now here I am running my startup. And my God, if every single job is tough, startuppers, chapeau. It is the by far the toughest job on earth. I came doing my startup with 15 years of experience in corporate, quite positive, quite solid, quite the right career. And I realized how difficult it is to be a startupper. You need to do everything. You need to wake up and collect and fundraise. By noon, you are purchasing something for your office. In the afternoon, you are having a Zoom with a client across the board. And then at evening, you are pitching to fundraise again and again. And it doesn't stop. It never stops like this. And then you need to hire people. And when you hire people, you need to tell them, to be honest, tell them, guys, we are a startup. You are leaving a corporate role, which might not get you the most excitement every day, but gives you salary to come here where excitement will be at the roof, but potentially you might not get the same salary as you go and then the same projection. Are you in to join? So did that for 2 years as a CEO, found it amazingly fun and amazingly tough. I must say there is time to do a startup and there's time not to do a startup. We had 4 children at the time. They were in full study mode and they told me after a while, like, hey, daddy, we don't see you. And we don't see you at all because I was completely embedded in my startup. And that was a wake-up call. Said, you know what? I need to a little bit backtrack. Became the chairman of my startup and of the board of the startup and ran it for a year and a half doing the chairmanship. And then I left it. And now the startup continued to grow. We did an exit recently and it's working very well. But my main learning of it is, A, you must do it. Do a startup in your life to realize what it means when a startupper come to you and pitch their business to you. Second, realize that you have a beginning and an end. A startup could be a roller coaster for all your life. They are serial entrepreneurs. These are, I would say, the heavy, very sick, if we call it as a virus, the one that are really into it, are really doing a lot. I did one. I realized what it is. I know how fun and how tough and how rewarding it is. But then searching, understand when you cut your losses and move, make a move out. My last thing about startup is, and that could be for our next conversation, is startup are cool but useless. Cool because you do everything. You can be very reactive. Useless if you want to grow. If you want to do partnerships with large organizations are too structured for startup. So you need to find the middle ground and become a scale-up.
Yeah, and look, that is a good segue because what you said essentially is, by the way, very familiar to me because I'm an entrepreneur. So I know it's not like having a startup, but in my own way, I experience what you say. But it's also very familiar with, you know, what clients say. Many CEOs, they've been founder before, now they become a CEO. And so when I work with them, they share exactly the same struggles, the same journey. Now, what I think is interesting, because before getting to how to scale up, right? Because I know is, and by the way, on this show, we had both founders, but also VCs. So, and they share exactly the same thing about the challenge of creating a strong partnership or connection between the startup and the investors. I wanted to ask you, as well as the organization, I wanted to ask you one thing before getting to scale up, and maybe it's a part of the same conversation, by the way. I'm interested in your view, based on all the decades of experience, is what is missing? I mean, you said before, you said the organizations, they are not structured to welcome startups, to integrate them into a business, and that's very consistent with the feedbacks I got. What do you think is the number one strategy for founders to integrate in the company the most effective way, but I'm more interesting what the companies can do in order to integrate their founder, because there are so many companies out there that they're corporate venture fund or they're investing in startups, but for any reason or another, they struggle really to get the most out of the investments in the startups. Is there one big lesson or two in terms of that's the way to go if you really want to integrate a startup in your business?
So if you're a large organization And I'm going to answer your question on both sides. What you should do as a startup to integrate with the large, and if you're a large, how to integrate small. Let me start with the startup. If you're a startup, do not pretend to integrate with large. It's you are too confusing. You are too fun, but disorganized. You are few people. You are running fast. You are in a disruption mode. You are not into the collaboration mode. You want to change the world, right? I got to revolutionize the way we drink, the way we eat, the way we walk, the way we drive. I'm going to revolutionize it. It's cool. Revolution is super cool, but revolution don't last. If you want to grow from revolution to political system, you need to establish. You need to evolve from a startup to scale up. Scale up is what? Is a team that with the right jobs description. Rather than I do A, B, C, and D, and by the way, E as well, and F, and this is what startup. You have the right people. You have enough money to run. You are not running after the fundraising. Because if a CEO is fundraising, a CEO is only fundraising. He or she cannot be doing the business. So you need to have the right people. You need to have the right money. But you don't need to have too much money, right? Because if not, you become a large organization that runs on other KPIs. Third, you need to have a stable technology. Enough technology that is documented. It's really about to have the right way of doing business. It's not that, can you do this? Yeah, of course I can do this. I will put my tech guy and he will do it for you. No, you need to have a documented information that could be shared. So I said money, people, technology. And finally, you need to have the right product. What do you sell? Who is your target? And be able to easily answer this question rather than, oh, I sell whatever you want to whoever you want because I'm looking after the money behind me. Yeah. You start to have a certain logic. And finally, all that is here not to disrupt the large, but to improve the large organization value chain. So that's for the startup. Don't disrupt, but improve. If you are a large organization, your DNA is risk averse. It's the DNA of any large organization. Large organization run after reputation challenge, after stock market evolution, run after winning the next large client. And all that come with being low on risk. Startup are putting everything on the table to try to be the best they can. So I always joke in saying, startups and large group have the same MVP in common. For a startup, it's a minimal viable product. So do it and throw it to the market and see. For a large organization, it's maximal viable product. Before you launch it, it has to be perfect. So large organization, if you feel that you can't do it alone, and basically you can't do it alone anymore. Why? Because you don't have enough talents. You don't have enough time. You don't have enough tech. And you don't have the right channels to deliver it. All these could come from scale-ups. So accept to go a little bit higher on risk and accept that the other one will not morph into you. Accept the difference. To link it with what we said, accept the multicultural. It's not here a geographical multicultural. It's a business multicultural. And I must tell you, it barely succeeds. It fails most of the time because large will always try to eat small and will always try to impose the risk aversion that they have into the small. And what happened at the end of the day, they ended up acquiring the small, feeding them with good salaries, and the small become risk averse as well. And that's the danger of it.
Yeah, and that creates actually the contrary what they want to generate. So, you know, all the good things about being in the startup world then is going to get completely eroded culturally, you know, from the large organization that essentially, you know, they want to acquire exactly those skills they are looking for, but they ended up actually turning something into the same old, the same old, or just another part of the organization. And I think that is a very, I like it. I mean, actually, the angle about risk is really good, by the way, because I did not think in that way before, is how you can essentially facilitate as a founder the risk the large organization feel every single day. On the same time, how a large organization can actually change a little bit the risk profile and their appetite for risk in order to really accept, you know, accept what the startups are bringing on the table. I think it's a very valid point. Very valid point. You mentioned about your certification about scaling up coach. So presumably what you do is, or you know, what you will do in the future. So whatever is your plan, right? But it's really is also based on your experience is helping founders or founders CEOs or CEOs, you know, CEOs of already existing scale up companies to scale faster based on your experience. Is there any other specific advice you would like to give to CEOs that are right now looking to scale their business?
I would say is surround yourself with the right people and take a coach. Scale up coach. I must say, in fact, I became a scale up coach once I did my startup and I realized that, oh my God, I thought I would know everything because I've been a business person for quite some time and I brought all my business skills to the startup. And I realized that the difference between the startup and the corporate. I did that. I ran it the startup and then I became the chairman. And then I've always been asking myself why it has been always difficult to connect with the large organization. And one day a large organization of my client told me it's because you don't have scale. And that was my minute of light. And I said, what is scale? What is scale up? And I searched about it and I found a coaching about scaling up. There's, by the way, a very good book called Scaling Up. If you are interested
in that book
and become a scale-up coach, it's worth it. It says it all. And so I became a scale-up coach, get certified there, and I found it very interesting. Few elements that came out of it. First, accept that you don't know it all if you are the CEO and get yourself supported by a scale-up coach. This is, I would say, the first thing. The second thing is accept not to control everything anymore, right? A startup, you know everybody. You know, and by the way, startup is not tech startup. Huh? It's small company to large company. It can be selling bread, selling tech, selling cars, selling whatever. But there is the idea of we created something. I know you. We've been together. We grew together. We did it together. And we talk to each other every single day. And one day we decide to open a branch in the south of France. So I'm not seeing you anymore. And then after that, we're saying we're doing it the same thing in Barcelona or in Italy or in the UK. And I don't see you anymore. And by the way, I don't know you anymore as much as the one that was sitting next to me. So accept to lose control in terms of or lose by relying on more people, right? It's not completely forget control, but it's accept that others will have a bigger portion of it. Third, accept that you don't know everything in the business. You don't know the product, the sales, the finance, and the tech. When it was small, it was easy. You would do everything. But it's like in education. You are the one who educates your child at the beginning, and then slowly but surely, there are teachers who will do it better than you, and there are professors who will do it better than you, and you become the one that least know about your son. So it's all about having the right people to do the right thing. Quite interesting what I get in my background. It's about having the right people to do the right thing. And finally, accept to increase the span of a deal. The scale come with a longer duration to sign a deal. It's part of the game. So you need to have the right financial means to accept a longer duration. And I would finish. Put routines, set up your weekly calls, your daily calls, and respect them. And let the people do their job. One day I was coaching a CEO who wanted to become a scale-up. And we were in a board conversation, and a guy showed up from the door and said, hey, the servers are heating. And I looked at the CEO, who should have said, thank you for informing me. You are in charge. And he stopped the board meeting and went to handle the servers, which he ended up doing very basic things, which is putting a ventilator to reduce the heat. And he came back very proud of saying, see how close I am to the business. And I told him, this is the exact opposite of what you're expecting to do, because you haven't empowered the person of saying, I trust you to solve it. Only if it's an escalation, come to see me. And by the way, between you and me, there are different people that should come into the game. So for me, let go, accept not to control everything, to be in the know, but not in the doing of everything across the whole value chain.
It's funny because, look, that's quite expected from many founders. They became a CEO because they're still so much connected or close to their own, you know, their own toy, let's put it in that way.
Baby.
Yes, probably that's the better word. It's baby, but also the operational side of a business. And from my experience, and you just shared yours, is letting that go is difficult. So from a mindset standpoint, and what I find is extremely fascinating, even more fascinating, is there are many CEOs of medium or even large companies, maybe not too large, but definitely medium-sized company, they're still in the same mindset of, I have to be on top of everything. I need to have control over the operations, which I don't think is a very good positioning for a CEO that needs to drive the future of the organization. So it's a great sharing, Elias. I think that is a good, very good reminder.
Andrea, if you allow me, I've always said to my CEO, you need to earn the time to get bored.
Yes.
And they will look at me saying, what do you mean get bored? In fact, a CEO at a certain stage, right, when you become a scale-up, your job is not to run the day-to-day. Your job is to make sure that tomorrow and after tomorrow and the day after is in place. And to put that in place, to have a vision, you need to be able to have the time to think. If you are so hands-on and you are running the show, you are driving and looking at the next corner. I want you to be looking far behind, on the other side, so you know how to prepare the future, the right to get bored. So your COO runs the day-to-day and you are able to project your organization for a better future.
So from a mindset standpoint, Elias, how can you help someone, you know, thinking or change or shift their perception about what has to be their role? So you give us a great example of someone has been interrupting a board, a CEO has been interrupting a board, and then he wanted to solve things himself. What is the, you know, how can people, you know, in that position can really understand, okay, I'm okay with the fact that it's not going to be me anymore to do that? What needs to be true for them to consider another view, another way of leading the company?
It's so funny because I had a friend of mine who recently had a heart attack. And this was the most extreme things to wake up in saying, oh my God, I need to change my life. Don't wait for that moment, right? Yeah. Don't wait for your wife or your companion to tell you, I can't live anymore with you. Don't wait for a heart attack. Don't wait for your financial officer to tell you, I need to leave because you are doing my job. Don't wait for your bank to come and tell you you are too close to everything. Don't wait for your investor to tell you you are not able to hire people for you.
Yeah.
Learn to let to. The sooner you learn to let go, but I'm not saying to forget about it, but accept that other could do it differently. In my own career, I always implemented, I call it the oops management. Oops mean error. Oops, I had a problem. Mm. I always say to the people I hire, look, my management style is oops management. Oops management comes with empowerment and trust. You are empowered. If I hired you, it's because you are the right person to do this job. And you are better than I to do it because you know what to do exactly into it. If not, I would not hire you. I'm not here to hire you to help me do my job. I'm hiring you to do your job. And I will tell you, you have a mission. Take me from A to Z. And to take me from A to Z, you should know how to do it. And I want you to be creative. And I want you to be provocative. And I want you to be differentiator. And 7 out of 10, statistically, you will do it great. You will, because you know what you are doing, you will go beyond. 3 out of 10, you will have a mistake. What I don't want you is to cover the mistake. at the opposite. I will tell you, call it out. Give me an oops call and tell me, Elias, look, I screwed up. This is what I tried to do and I screwed up. And the minute you tell me this is an oops call, I'm not anymore sitting in front of you. I'm sitting next to you. And we are now the two trying to solve the problem. But the only way to implement the OOPS methodology is to trust and empower the people. And that would be my advice. Trust and empower your people. Give them a free way to deliver. Give them the trust and establish the rule of engagement and saying, when shit happens, raise your hand. I will be next to you, not in front of you, finger pointing, but I will be next to you, co-solving the problem.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So great. I think that is a very good approach and attitude to lead, you know, a scaling organization. Last question I have for you, Elias. If we move a little bit more into the leadership element. So we touched on this, but what do you think are the specific leadership skills that, you know, a CEO needs to acquire as much as possible and as soon as possible, especially when it comes to scaling? You know, we mentioned mindset, we mentioned strategy, operational support. So it's all in service, by the way. But I'm curious if there is any specific leadership blind spot that you see in CEOs. They are probably not scaling up properly, or they're not ready to scale up from a leadership standpoint.
There's plenty, always. We always find what goes wrong, but we barely see what goes right. For me, what goes right, what are the ingredients of the right CEO is their humanity. If they know how to talk to people, number one, right? Mm-hmm. Attract people, work with people, have them with them, and engage with them. So the humanity of the people. Second is the skill. I do not pretend to be a tech person. I need to be educated about tech. I might have an opinion about the consequence of tech, but I will never put my hands into it because I will break it and accept my limitations. Third, I have a focus. If my role is the customer experience, in that case, whatever you tell me, I will tell you who is the persona. Are you talking to the client? Are you talking to the parents of the client? Are you talking to the neighbor of the client? And have the different perspectives. So accept to put every conversation through the personas. And finally, drive the results. What is the goal? Where shall we be? And when shall we be there? Are we selling? Are we building? Are we moving? And by when? The worst thing I hate is when I ask someone, by when shall we do that? And the answer will be Q1. And my answer is, January 1st. And in their mind, it's March 31st. And right. For me, whenever you tell me Q1, I take the first day of the quarter. I don't take the last day of the quarter. So be precise in your commitment to what you will deliver. And always, and maybe I failed today, keep it short. Be able to make your point in very few sentences.
Well, especially if you're looking for actually foundings, but also at some point you need to go to market and et cetera. So it's strong advice, a very good advice, commitment, you know, language, the way how you talk, communicate. I think it's a very solid advice. And by the way, I'm so glad that you touch on humanity because for two reasons. So one, because that is my way of thinking about leadership for the future. So it's a human CEOs and human leaders that is going to outperform all the other type of CEOs and also get better results at the end. It also consistent with my book I'm writing about how humanity is going to drive better performance in the future. So that will be probably an amazing actually pitch for the book I'm writing, and in the next few months will be available for everyone. So, Elias, last question before I let you crack on. I know you are in Montreal for work, so we discussed about the temper too. But then, more importantly, there is one question I did not ask you that you want the audience be left with about this. One final takeaway is a point that you say, yes, I want to really to share this because we didn't share it so far.
Hmm. It's funny because when you were talking about multicultural, I talked a lot about the geographical cultures, people that you meet around in terms of language and so on. But I think for me, diversity, and yes, it's cliche, but it is important. Not only important for the equality, right? I don't really care about equality. I care about diversity. I care about different mind of views. Equality is important, but it's only a step towards the true diversity. The more you bring people, you surround yourself with different genders, different cultures, different perspective, the richer become the idea. And that's why, for me, men and women complement very well. They don't have to be equal. There is not a better or a worse or a bigger and a smaller. There is complementarity. And focusing on having the right complementarity, when you look around you, you must see diverse colors, diverse accents, diverse genders.
Yeah.
And that's what will make the success a common success, which can last long, rather than a personal short-term success. That will be my last word.
And I think it's consistent with all the conversation we had, because if you are scaling a startup or growing any sort of organizations, what you really need is understanding different cultures, how you can, you know, really integrate it with the idea of getting the most out of everyone, different thoughts, different ideas. Mm-hmm. So that is a great message and manifesto for diversity in any sort of organization, not just in the startup world. So, Elias, thank you so much for this conversation. That's been awful. Where people should go if they want to understand a little bit more about you, what you're doing, you know, as a scale-up coach, but also what you're doing in Capgemini?
Well, look, my LinkedIn is quite active and engaged. We are launching a world report, as you mentioned at the beginning. I lead the world report series of Capgemini Financial Services. We just launched last week the world report on retail banking. We came up with major impact on where banks, retail banks are in their journey to AI, and they are very at the beginning. We will have soon a property and casualty insurance. We will have after that a wealth, which will be on the ultra high net worth individual. So my LinkedIn is quite active. Reach out to me there and you will get to know more about me there, and very happy to connect with all of you as needed.
Superb. Thank you so much, Elias, and have a wonderful rest of the day.
Andrea, thank you so much for having me on your show. Have a great day. Bye-bye.